Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are wrapping up our coverage of presidential candidates by discussing former Vice President Joe Biden. You can find our coverage of the other candidates at yourcallradio.org. Joe Biden has a very long career in politics. He served as Senator of Delaware from 1973 to 2009, and then he became former President Barack Obama's vice president. So far, Biden's campaign has raised over $76 million, with over 63% of that money coming from large contributors. This is according to Open Secrets. 44 billionaires and their spouses are supporting Biden, according to Forbes. That list includes former Hewlett-Packard CEO Meg Whitman, a Republican, ex-Google CEO Eric Schmidt, and Eli Broad, a major supporter of charter schools. 18 of those billionaires got rich in finance and investments, 6 in hedge funds, 5 in private equity, and 7 owe their fortunes to real estate and 5 to the tech sector. Biden is also closely tied to the super PAC Unite the Country. They're providing him with a lot of ads on television, and that is backed by billionaire real estate magnate George Marcus and Massimo co-founder Joe Chiani. That group has raised about $3.8 million. Now, at last night's debate, Joe Biden says he will definitely win South Carolina on Saturday, and he needs that victory after coming in a distant second in Nevada and fifth place in New Hampshire. Joining us to talk about Joe Biden's record, his platform, and his donors is Matt Brunig, founder and president of the People's Policy Project, a think tank whose primary mission is to publish ideas and analysis that assist in the development of an economic system that serves the many, not the few. Matt focuses on issues that affect poor and working people. He previously worked as a lawyer with the National Labor Relations Board and as a policy analyst at the Demos think tank, and he's been writing extensively about all of the candidates' health care plans. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you for joining us. First off, Matt, the debate last night was really a mess. At first, as expected, everybody went after Bernie Sanders, and then they tried to go after Bloomberg. What did you think overall, and specifically Joe Biden's performance?
Yeah, I think mess pretty much sums it up well. It's not really a good format to talk about healthcare policy, especially complicated aspects of healthcare policy. The politicians don't always necessarily understand their own plans or the plans of their opponents, and then they have 30 seconds to try to say something about it. And I just can't imagine. I mean, I'm someone who reads a lot of this stuff and like spends my whole day kind of working on this stuff, and so I can kind of follow it. I just can't imagine a normal person being able to follow what's going on. It seemed incomprehensible to me. As far as Joe's performance, you know, I don't know. It's hard to judge. You know, he is kind of a charming figure on stage. It seems like from time to time he's kind of got this all shucks sort of attitude. You know, so that seems to work for some people. On the policy points, is like everyone else. Very muddled, a little hard to follow.
Well, let's talk a little bit about his donors, because we have been talking about people who are giving to the campaigns during this series. And Biden is getting a lot of money from private equity, from real estate, from finance. I mean, a lot of Democrats get this money. What are your thoughts on this? What really stands out for you?
Yeah, Joe is running in a kind of an old school campaign almost. You know, after 2016, Bernie Sanders proved that, especially with the new online, you know, giving and how easy it is to go on Act Blue, which is where basically everyone raises money these days, how easy it is to go on Act Blue and just raise huge sums of money from, you know, regular people donating 20, 30 bucks at a time. That seemed to be like the future. And Elizabeth Warren copied that this time for the most part and was pretty good at that. And Biden is still stuck in the past, meaning he's going around what they call the rubber chicken circuit, where you go do these dinners where you charge people $2,000 a plate, and it's stuff like that, and just reaching out to affluent people and their networks and seeing if they'll pour money in. And what's interesting about it is, it is corrupting, I think, of course, to bring that money in. But also, it's not as effective anymore. Mm-hmm. He's raised a lot less money than Sanders and even than Warren, even though he's polling higher than Warren, because he's got no real base of support who is willing to put in $20-$30. He only has these really rich donors.
And Matt, what do you think has happened to Joe Biden? I mean, last year, so many people called him a front runner and said, you know, and this is a lot of mainstream people, the pundits on cable shows, and said, this is the guy who really could take on Trump. I mean, even people who weren't sure about Biden thought that he would do much better than he did in Iowa and New Hampshire. What do you think explains that?
Yeah, I mean, I was right along with everyone else. You know, he led in the polls since there were polls, for like a whole year. He led in the polls. He never was behind. And then coming into Iowa, he started to collapse. Partially, one explanation here is the polls are maybe not as useful an indicator early on. A lot of people don't make up their minds in Iowa until a week or two before. And so if you kind of poll Iowa or poll the country, people just, there are these placeholder candidates, if you will. Oh, I know Joe Biden. He was the VP. Sure, that's my guy. And then when they have a moment, you know, before the vote, oh, well, the vote's in a week. Let me check this out, pay a little bit more attention. That support seemed to evaporate a bit. And it was very soft, I guess, would be another way to put it. People like Bernie Sanders have a lot of diehard supporters, for better or worse, that, you know, gives him a really hard floor that is hard for him to go below. Biden, you know, people are kind of wishy-washy. You don't have a lot of passionate Biden supporters. The last thing I'll say on this, the only thing I could think of as an event that occurred that might explain it is about a week or two or 3 weeks before the Iowa primary, the Bernie Sanders campaign in particular, which, you know, was 1-2, Biden was their big threat, they started pushing out all this content about Biden's history on Social Security and Medicare, saying for decades and decades that he wanted to cut Medicare, cut Social Security, freeze benefit increases, that kind of thing. For a long time, Biden was kind of hawkish on entitlement reform, as they'll say. And they pushed that out pretty hard, and it got in the Times. You know, it got into the discourse, and that might have affected him as well.
We got a comment from someone on Twitter who says, are you going to talk about the credit card companies supporting Biden? Since he was a senator from Delaware, I have not heard much about this in the campaign. Thanks for that tweet, Noel. And we just did a little bit of research and just learned that the MBNA Corporation, which represents banks out of Delaware, it looks like it was acquired by Bank of America in 2006, but this is basically a lobbying firm for a lot of the banks. Biden has received $200,000 from the MBNA over the course of his career. And the other thing that I just learned about Biden, Matt, Ida Chavez over at The Intercept reports that Biden is getting quite a bit of money from union-busting law firms. There's one law firm that she cites in her piece, Jackson Lewis. It's one of the most notorious mm-hmm. union busting law firms in the country. They're supporting Biden. Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar have also received support from partners at anti-union firms, but both receive far less from these law firms than Biden.
Interesting. Yeah. So MBNA was, I believe, the largest employer in Delaware for most of Biden's career. So, you know, there's a sort of a hometown thing that senators do, yeah, for better or worse. Another note on MBNA is that Biden's son worked for MBNA, Hunter Biden, who is now the source of all sorts of controversy recently. And, you know, I don't know how these things happen, but obviously it looks suspicious when the largest employer in the state that you're a senator of hires your son to work for them. So, you know, it's a little shady. And Biden, you know, and Warren has made the most of this point. In the early 2000s, there was a big push to reform the bankruptcy laws. and Biden was always coming out in favor of the credit card company's position. The credit card companies obviously want to make it difficult for people to discharge debts because, you know, people run up a credit card debt and then they want to discharge it. At least that's how they see it. And he was always on the credit card company side. Warren was always on the debtor side, and there was a kind of battle that occurred there in the early 2000s. But like the tweeter said, not a lot has been made of that in this campaign. Warren hasn't made a whole lot about it either. As far as the anti-union firm, Jackson Lewis, I'll tell you, I worked at the National Labor Relations Board, which is the agency that regulates unions and employers in that context. And yeah, they are they're the big guys. They're the big guns that you call if you really want to bust a union or try to beat them when you're representing people before the agency. So, you know, I don't know how are these just random people who work at the company? Maybe Joe and these other candidates don't have much, you know, much to say about that. They just go to the website and send it on. But, you know, it's not a great indicator, obviously, that those kinds of people want to support your campaign.
Matt Bruneig is founder and president of the People's Policy Project. This is a think tank that really focuses on developing an economic system that serves the many, not the few. Now I would like to welcome Branko Marcetic to the show. Branko is a staff writer at Jacobin. This is a magazine and online outlet offering leftist perspectives on economics and politics. Branko is also a contributor for In These Times and a Leonard Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting fellow. Hi, Branko. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
Great to have you. So, Branko, you're out with a new book that is very critical of Joe Biden. You've done a lot of extensive research. I mean, I learned so much about Joe Biden from the articles that I read and the excerpt of your book that I read. We'll get into that in a minute. But first off, is there anything else that stands out for you? We've been spending a little bit of time talking about Joe Biden's donors. I mean, these are typical people that give to, you know, Democrats that take money from private equity, real estate, finance. Anything stand out for you?
Yeah, one of the things that I've been thinking about is just the way that, you know, on the one hand, if you look at it at face value, the field before us is, you know, the most progressive field perhaps ever in a Democratic primary. The things they're proposing, you know, everyone's proposing at least a public option, a public health insurance option on the healthcare front, for example. But the interesting thing there is that they're also getting money from industries that are directly opposed to such an option. I mean, you know, we think of Medicare for All as being particularly scary to the health insurance industry and big pharma and all that, and that is true. But also, these are the same industries that rallied against the public option back in 2009 when Obama took office. And, you know, interestingly, actually, you launched the exact same kind of attacks against it that you hear from the likes of Biden and Buttigieg right now about Medicare for All. You know, saying that, oh, you know, it'll rip people's health care away, it'll destroy Medicare, you know, it's too expensive, it's a government takeover, all this kind of stuff. All the stuff that Biden and Buttigieg are saying about Medicare for All, the industries that are funding them, their campaigns, were saying about the public option, which now they're proposing. So to me, there's a big disconnect between what people are actually proposing in their platforms and, you know, the engines that drive their campaigns and what they actually want.
We were also talking about what happened to Biden in the polls and why he did so poorly in New Hampshire and came in at, you know, a distant second in Iowa. I'm sorry, in the Nevada caucuses. And a listener writes in, the impeachment hearings raised a lot of questions about Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, and his work in Ukraine, and a lot of doubts about Joe Biden's honesty. This listener says that may explain his drop in the polls. What are your thoughts on that, Branko?
Yeah, I think the impeachment, you know, I think on the one hand, the Democrats were thinking they would go the route of impeachment because it was a way to defend Biden from these attacks by Trump. But I think actually it backfired. It did the exact opposite because, you know, as much as the Democrats want to say, well, you know, everything that happened was legal, everything was nice and legal and okay, you know, that's not a particularly strong defense. There's a lot of corruption that takes place in Washington that is perfectly legal, but it's just unseemly and obviously a conflict of interest. And, you know, Hunter Biden ending up on the board of this gas company is one example of that. And I think what the impeachment thing did really was it was meant to sort of remind us again and again that, you know, Trump is kind of, you know, was abusing the power of his office, and that, you know, he's this kind of scurrilous politician who would do anything, I guess, to take out his opponents. But I think what it did instead was just remind people again and again that Biden and his family had engaged in you know, it might be legal, but still nonetheless corruption, you know, that at the same time that this company was launching a lobbying effort in the United States, at the same time that Biden was the point man for the Obama administration in Ukraine, they put his son, who has no experience, on the board of the company to make $10,000 a month. I mean, I think for a lot of people, as much as the Democrats tried to say, again, illegal, it's above board, most people saw through that. I think people instinctually realize that, you know, something smells bad in this whole affair. And to be honest, there's a lot about this whole thing that we still don't know, despite the fact that people say it's been reported everywhere in U.S. media that the investigation into the company was closed by the time that Biden got rid of this prosecutor. The Russian opposition newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, which is heavily praised by liberals because it's an anti-Putin paper, they reported back in October last year that the investigation was still open when that prosecutor was fired. Doesn't mean that Biden fired him for that reason, but it does mean that I think that the story around that is not quite as clear-cut as people are, I think, wanting it to be.
Today we are talking about Joe Biden's platform record and donors. Today is the last day of our coverage of presidential candidates. You can find all of the other candidates at yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Branko Marcetic, a staff writer at Jacobin. He also writes for In These Times. Matt Brunig is founder and president of the People's Policy Project. Branko, since you did go in depth on Biden, We can't go way back because we want to really talk about where he is today and where he's going. But as you write, when he was a newly elected senator, he was a fairly standard liberal politician for the early 1970s. And then you write that he really did change, especially when it comes to Social Security and Medicare. So can you just talk briefly? I mean, if we had more time, we'd be able to go far back. But talk about some of the transitions that Biden has made over his career, especially when it comes to Social Security and Medicare.
Oh, sure. Sorry. Yeah, well, Biden started out, as you say, as a kind of a New Deal liberal, kind of ambivalent New Deal liberal. I mean, people at the time, there was a state party chairman who said at the time that, Biden actually didn't really have any firm ideological commitments. But, you know, I think that was the direction of U.S. policy at the time. And so he started his campaign kind of calling for increases in Social Security benefits. He started calling for fixes on prices and interest rates and that kind of thing, and really ran a very economically populist campaign in that first 72 campaign. By 78, the politics in the United States, the landscape had really shifted because you have the Taxpayers' Rebellion in 1978, this big kind of anti-tax revolt that starts in California and kind of sweeps across the country over the next few years. Obviously, Reagan wins in 80 and again in 84. I think that really shifts the political landscape.
Good. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm being instructed I can't sit on the floor here. This is on the radio. Thanks. And so, where was I? That really shifts the political landscape. And then Biden really turns because I think he looks at these big changes. He looks at Reagan's big landslides and he says, well, I can't be the same kind of politician I was earlier. And it's in that 78 re-election campaign, his first re-election, where he faces a Republican, and he makes a major shift on all these things. He starts calling for a ceiling on the federal bureaucracy, on employment there. He starts calling for a massive tax cut, and pretty soon he's calling for, you know, maybe even a balanced budget amendment. By the 80s, he's calling for a freeze in federal spending. You know, we have to get deficits under control. And what I argue in the book is that 78 election really taught him the lesson that the way to win was, you know, not to go with that economically populist route that he took in 72, which won him the surprise election victory that did, but rather to try and poach his opponent's platform, his Republican opponent's platform, and sort of move to the right and try and maybe take some voters away from Republicans.
Matt, what are your thoughts? What else can you add about some of the changes that we saw with Biden? As Bronco points out in one of his pieces, Bronco, we're going to actually call you back to see if we can find a quieter space because we're having a hard time hearing you. Sorry about that. I think Bronco had to go to a train station at the last minute. So he points out in one of his pieces that Biden's anti-spending proselytizing actually won him the endorsement of Howard Jarvis, who's the anti-government California businessman who championed Prop 13. And, you know, we're still paying the price for Prop 13. That's actually going to be on the ballot here in California in November. What else can you tell us about some of the shifts that Biden has made over the years?
You know, Biden, I'm not as much an expert, obviously, as Bronco is, but he seems to have been a pretty normal politician, I guess. He sort of moves with the tides of the Democratic Party, for better or worse. It's not unlike Hillary Clinton, honestly. Hillary Clinton was somewhat more conservative in 2008 and certainly in the 90s than she was in 2016, at least the way that she ran. And so, you know, it's a little hard with politicians, obviously, to figure out what it is they really believe. For someone like Joe and a lot of politicians, I think he's pretty normal in this regard. You know, what it is he believes is that he likes being a senator or a president or an elected official. And whatever it is that, you know, people are saying, whatever it is that's popular at the time, you know, he's for it.
You know,
that seems to be the case.
Matt, we actually have a bad line with you. Why don't we, let's try to get Matt and Bronco back, and I will just read an article. Really sorry about these lines. I'm not sure why. I'm just getting a loud noise, and I'm sure you are too. So I'm going to read a piece from Vox while we try to get better lines from them, because obviously people want to know what the record is, but we also want to know what they're going to do. So Vox has a piece by Matthew Iglesias called Joe Biden's Plan to Raise Taxes on Corporations and the Rich Explained. So here's some information about what he would actually do. Joe Biden wants to see higher taxes on the rich, especially those who derive most of their income from stock ownership and other investments. And this is according to a detailed revenue plan. Biden's overall vision for increasing social spending in the United States is ambitious, headlined by a $1.7 trillion climate plan, a $750 billion health plan, and a $750 billion education plan, but significantly less so than the ideas that left-wing rivals Bernie and Warren have put on the table. His tax ideas are less dramatic than the new wealth tax proposal Warren made famous, to say nothing of the even bigger wealth tax Sanders has proposed, often sounding more like tedious accounting details than visionary plans. They would roughly equal Biden's $3.2 trillion in spending proposals over a decade. Iglesias also reports that even though Biden's proposals on this front are much more moderate, they are almost identical in their orientation, raising money from a similar group of people for mostly similar reasons. If Biden's plans were enacted, taxes on capital owners would end up much higher than they were at the end of Obama's tenure, even as taxes on the working and middle classes are lower. So there's some information about Joe Biden's tax plan, and we will link to this at yourcallradio.org. And hopefully after the break, we will have better line connection. Sorry about that. With our guests today, Matt Brunig and Bronco Corachetti. This is Your Call. Today we're talking about Joe Biden's platform, his record, and his donors. And we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Or you can tweet us. Our handle is @yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, I am very excited about tomorrow's show because I've been trying to book Will B and Kev Marcus for 3 years. They are incredible musicians who've infused hip-hop and classical music to form Black Violin. And they've been changing perceptions about who can play what instrument or what type of music. Their shows are high energy, they're inspiring, and they're completely against the grain. And if you are in a city where they're playing, you can find information online. They're actually going to be playing in San Francisco tomorrow night. They're currently touring the United States. They are incredible. If you ever get a chance, please go see Black Violin, and I hope you can join us for tomorrow's show. Today, we are wrapping up our coverage of presidential candidates by talking about former Vice President Joe Biden. You can find all of the other candidates at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Matt Brunig, founder and president of the People's Policy Project. This is a think tank that focuses on developing an economic system that serves the many, not the few. Bronco Marchetich is a staff writer at Jacobin. He's a contributor for In These Times, and he's out with a new book that is critical of Joe Biden called Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
So much for the show. I've enjoyed all the shows on the candidates. I just wanted to put out on Joe Biden, when he was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he was able to get the Iraq war through by doing the same thing that he did to Anita Hill. In other words, all the witnesses had stepped up and testified why we should invade Iraq. And when the very first witness, some of these people, you know, Congress people, senators, when they started to testify against it, he called a lunch break, and they never actually got the chance to testify. Hmm. And that's what he did with Anita Hill. In other words, she was not allowed to have any of her corroborating witnesses. So we just need to know who this guy Joe Biden is. I mean, he runs the process for, you know, the war crowd. And I'll take a response on the issue. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really glad you brought this up. I was hoping that given the Harvey Weinstein guilty verdict on some counts, that would have been brought up last night. Because this has really been following Joe Biden for many, many years. And he did express regret to Anita Hill, but she says, "I'm sorry" is not enough. There's a piece in the New York Times last April about this. And if you get a chance, there's an amazing documentary about Anita Hill, and it does a great job of bringing in the footage and just how much power Biden had to bring in or not bring in women to testify. Matt, I'm not sure if you can speak to this, but I mean, this is really important given how much things have changed since that case, and you know what happened to Anita Hill when she was a young woman back then.
Yeah, for sure. You know, if we're going to take seriously, you know, issues around Me Too and sexual harassment and that sort of thing, his behavior back then obviously was completely unacceptable. He kind of generally behaves in a little bit of a weird way around women. Maybe that's an understatement. There are a lot of photos of him seemingly, you know, rubbing shoulders with women, like, for no, without consent, I guess you would say, in public settings, petting them, etc. And I don't know, he thinks that that's acceptable. He's, you know, 75-year-old man or something, but that seems to be the way he engages these things. There was another article written last year, I believe, by Lucy Flores, who was a politician in, I want to say Nevada, maybe it was another state, who said that Biden had, you know, come up to her and, you know, basically started rubbing her shoulders and that sort of thing. And you know, I'm sure he thinks that's harmless, but obviously it's not acceptable. But for whatever reason, that has not gotten traction in this campaign. You know, I don't know why.
The other thing is, Joe Biden talks a lot about the Violence Against Women Act. This was a legislation that was passed 25 years ago. He says this is the proudest moment of his career in the Senate. And today, many experts, I'm reading from Time Magazine now, credit VAWA with contributing to a dramatic decrease in the rate of domestic violence in the United States. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, the overall rate of intimate partner violence dropped 64% from 1993 to 2010. I didn't realize it was that big. So what about this? I mean, this is a really important piece of legislation, and Joe Biden talks about this a lot.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things. You see, with a lot of powerful people, it seems like, where they are able to distinguish between what they do in their official capacity and how they behave interpersonally. You know, the slight against Anita Hill was an interpersonal slight, though obviously it affected who was on the court. The way that he is a handsy, I guess you would say, with women, that's an interpersonal thing. But, you know, I'm sure he goes around day to day in his life, and like most people, thinks it's very bad when, you know, people are, when, you know, domestic violence is really bad, that rape and assault is really bad, and then he wants to do things, you know, he wants to do things to stop that. So, you know, it's a question of how much, what do you care about? You know, do you care about his interpersonal behavior? Do you care about what he might do as a politician? Frankly, the conservatives had a similar question with Trump last time around, and there are a lot of reports. You know, you ask individual voters and they'll say, yeah, you know, Trump is kind of a gross guy as a person, but, you know, he's going to do what I want him to do in office, and that's more important to me.
There's some other news about Biden and issues that are very important to so many people around abortion. Eon Higgins for Common Dreams writes that Biden's campaign confirmed last June that he still supports the anti-choice Hyde Amendment. His support for the policy 43 years after it was first signed into law is a sign that he is out of step with his party. New York Magazine writer Rebecca Tracer tweeted, "This put him at odds with his own party's platform at this point." And this amendment was passed back in 1976, and it restricts the use of federal funding for abortion. It has been cited as a major setback for abortion rights and one of the main reasons that poor women, women of color, and girls find it very difficult to access reproductive health services. So on this one, Biden really is out of step with even the mainstream of the Democratic Party.
This I think goes back to the question of what kind of politician is Biden. I think Biden is the kind of go with the flow Democrat. And in this case, I know the instance you're talking about. I think he was asked this question and he said, yeah, I'm for Hyde Amendment. I think it was literally a week later he reversed on that and, you know, put out stuff, said, oh, no, I'm against it now. So that sort of goes to show you, you know, I would believe is he had no idea that there was a sea change in the view on this within the Democratic Party. And one little, you know, factoid on this way, which might make you, you know, realize why he had no idea that the Democrats, you know, they have a different line on it now, is that the Affordable Care Act, when it passed, one of the sort of legislative difficulties was because of the weird procedural way in which they had to pass it, they were unable to put something in the bill that would essentially keep the Hyde restrictions in place for, like, Obamacare plans. And Obama promised the Congress, you know, to try to make sure to get some conservative Democrats to make them feel comfortable that once it got passed, he would write an executive order that would essentially, you know, make sure that the Hyde rule applied to Obamacare plans and that sort of thing. And once it passed and made into law, and Obama did, in fact, write that executive order and issue it. So, you know, while Biden is VP, he's seeing, oh, Obama, you know, the Democratic Party, we're still for the Hyde Amendment. And things obviously have moved a lot in the last 4 years, and he was not aware of that. And then he reversed the week later. So, you know, make of that what you will.
We also got a question about Biden's support for the invasion of Iraq. And this has come up several times on the debate stage, especially from Bernie Sanders. There's a new film out called Worth the Price, Joe Biden and the Launch of the Iraq War. And it's directed by the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Mark Weisbrot. And it exposes Biden's central role in pushing for the invasion. And Mark was on Democracy Now! Last month. What about this vote, Matt, and Biden's foreign policy experience? Anything else stand out for you there?
Yeah, you know, Biden has been a hawk. He's been very interested in foreign policy, it seems like, all of his career, and very interested in a way that involves a lot of intervention. His Iraq stuff was really strange. I mean, of course, he voted for it. A lot of Democrats voted for it. His justification for it is sounds even worse than the idea of voting for it because he thought it was a good idea. His justification for it is that essentially George Bush tricked him into voting for it by telling him, oh, vote for the war, but I won't actually do it. I'll just use it as a bargaining chip at the UN. And then he voted for it, and then, of course, we saw what happened. That is his official story, which makes him seem kind of naive and oafish. But also that official story is really questionable because at the time, there's all sorts of contemporaneous statements in which he's saying he's for the war, he's for the war, he's for the invasion. So that seems not believable. Also, during the Iraq War, he had all sorts of strange opinions, like he wanted to cut Iraq into three new countries. Just sort of weird, I don't know, almost sort of like colonial, you know, drawing lines on maps kind of stuff. It's very, I don't know, for someone who's not that interested in going in and telling other countries what to do and cutting them up and invading them, it does seem kind of, it's a sort of a disgusting approach to things.
Well, thank you for the call, and I'm sorry about these loud pops. I'm not sure what that is. Maybe we can try to fix that on our end. Today, we are talking about Joe Biden's platform, his record, and his donors. You can find all of the other coverage we've done about presidential candidates at yourcallradio.org. Matt Bruning is founder and president of the People's Policy Project. This is a think tank. They focus on the development of an economic system that serves the many, not the few, with a focus on low income and working people. And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And hopefully we have a better line with Bronco, who found a quieter space. Bronco Marchetic is a staff writer at Jacobin and a contributor for In These Times. Hopefully we have a better line with you, Bronco. In doing all of your research about Joe Biden, what else struck you about his foreign policy? We did just talk about his support for the invasion of Iraq. Anything else you can share with us?
On the one hand, under Obama, Biden was actually one of the more non-interventionist people that was advising Obama. You know, he was arguing against the surge in Afghanistan. He argued against the bombing of Libya, which has had disastrous consequences. He also was more skeptical of the killing of Osama bin Laden. That's kind of points in the good column for him. At the same time, he has shown his propensity to sort of get carried away with some of the militaristic fever that breaks out in Washington every now and then, and kind of jump on board with that. You know, the Iraq War was a really great example of that, obviously. And even the solution that Biden took for once the Iraq War had been launched and Iraq fell into chaos, you know, Biden, it's sort of, this hasn't been mentioned as much now, but Biden came up with this idea to basically partition Iraq into three kind of zones that will be segregated by on ethnic and sectarian and religious lines, which a lot of people in Washington thought was a great idea. A lot of actual experts in the Middle East and in Iraq thought that was a horrible, horrible idea that it would actually only increase violence. And unfortunately, it was never implemented. Going back before that, Biden started out his career as a kind of, Vietnam War opponent. He had to be kind of prodded into it by the press at first, but when he started campaigning in 72, he really, really was very, very out front and trying to get troops out of Vietnam. But again, similar to his economic policies, in the 80s, this really changed once Reagan won his two big landslides. And Biden basically went around the country touring and telling Democrats they had to change. And they were saying, you know, we have to get rid of this foreign policy that cringes at the use of force and that, you know, refuses to take any military action whatsoever. and really become a little more like Reagan. And through the 80s, even though he opposed some things, like Reagan's funding of the Contras in Central America, he did back a number of laws. You know, he backed Reagan's action against Libya. He backed the war in Grenada. He backed Bush's invasion of Panama. And he opposed Bush's Gulf War initially, but afterwards, when it was a sort of considered a resounding success in Washington, he really changed his mind and said, "Well, you know, clearly, Chris, you, Bush did the right thing, and I was wrong. I shouldn't have opposed this war. This is the right thing to do." So he, you know, he's not again, no firm ideological commitments. I think he's someone that he looks at the prevailing mood of the time and he goes, "What's the way that I should go based on how the public's looking?" And you know, if there is a lot of clamor for war, I think he's the kind of president who would be very likely to give into it.
Today we are talking about Joe Biden's platform, record, and policies. I mean, you just think about what Trump has done around the world, and I mean, the major changes that need to happen if a Democrat wins on everything from, you know, foreign policy to, I mean, it's just a shift no matter who comes in, obviously. But what are your thoughts about that, Bronco? I mean, when you think about just how much has changed under Trump just on foreign policy? I mean, we have reporters on who say that, you know, even if obviously the United States on many levels does so many things that are hypocritical. I mean, Bernie brought this up last night. But the fact is, if a president goes to a country, I don't know, let's name the country, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and even the mere mention of human rights is actually a big deal, right? Even for those of us who are very critical of U.S. foreign policy. I mean, you're not getting this basic language with Donald Trump. So this is going to be a major shift. So it is interesting to think, what kind of foreign policy would Joe Biden actually embrace? What kind of people would he put in power, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a low bar. You know, I think you're right that things would improve under almost anyone. But at the same time, you know, part of the phenomenon with Trump is that because people are so reflexively opposed to him, things that he does that any other president has done kind of come in for widespread condemnation and criticism, and you know, justified, I think. But for example, you know, when he made friendly overtures to Egypt, well, you know, the Obama administration also called up to him as well earlier. There just wasn't the same kind of outcry of Obama kind of pulling dictators. The same with Saudi Arabia. I mean, I think a lot of that would continue. I think you're right that, yes, there would be a shift in foreign policy. Certainly, I think there wouldn't be the kind of Trump-style, you know, friendliness with dictators and that kind of thing, at least, you know, one-to-one. But I think as an official Washington policy, I think that would continue.
Right.
You know, when you look at the candidates that are running right now, I mean, yes, they're all making a big change from Trump, but they're not going as far. No one is, not even, you know, Sanders and Warren. No one's going as far as really kind of going back and removing some of these things that were instituted as part of the war on terror under Bush and Obama. You know, even Sanders says he's going to keep using drones. I think he said that, well, you know, our targeted assassinations, they're gonna go down, lay down if I'm president. And sure, that's a okay change, but not really a very firm commitment. It doesn't really deal with the essential problem, which is that the drone program is essentially a lawless program. It's just that the president gets to decide who dies, and a drone pilot somewhere carries that order out to the best of his or her ability, sometimes with really horrific consequences, not just in terms of killing civilians, but, you know, as we saw in the hands of a president like Trump, that can be used to merely start a regional conflict.
Right.
So no one's really advocating that, and I don't think it's going to change under Biden.
Yeah, and we should remember, and we did a lot of shows about this, according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, Obama's covert drone war in numbers, 10 more strikes than Bush. I mean, this was just absolutely horrific for civilians on the ground, and Joe Biden was obviously vice president under Barack Obama. Today, we are talking about Joe Biden's record policy and donors with Matt Brunig, founder and president of the People's Policy Project. Branko Marchetic is a staff writer at Jacobin. He also writes for In These Times. And let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Thank you for holding.
Hello. Thank you. A couple of things about Biden's record on race. Throughout his career, this has been really sketchy, to say the least. I mean, you can go all the way back to things like, and I'll try to make this brief, busing. He was not an advocate for busing. I think there was an issue in Massachusetts with regard to busing. You can come forward to Anita Hill, and we've got Clarence Thomas now. That's already been mentioned by one of the callers. He's also, during the Clinton era, when the crime bill was passed, he was a supporter of the crime bill. The reason I'm raising this is that there are black politicians in South Carolina who are now supporting Biden. They've come out recently supporting him. And supposedly he's got in the polls a fairly widespread support among black people. And I'm looking at his record on race, and particularly with blacks in this country, and I'm thinking, I don't understand why any black person would think that this guy's really going to help them out. I mean, his record on race has just been atrocious. So I'd really love to understand why. I can understand the black Democratic establishment supporting him. That may be a given. But I just don't understand why he's got this alleged popularity amongst black, given his history on race.
Well, he just this morning got a boost from South Carolina Congressman Jim Clyburn. And a lot of people, in fact, Matt, last night, Biden said he is certain he's going to win South Carolina. So, I mean, what are your thoughts about this? I have to say, we were talking earlier today about how it feels a little uncomfortable when people, and I'm not saying this to you, Greg, but last night on the debate stage, you just get these politicians saying black vote, you know, blacks here. I think Biden said something like, I walk with blacks. I mean, this is not a monolith. There are a lot of differences among the African-American community, but the fact is Joe Biden does have a lot of support among the African-American community in South Carolina. So what are your thoughts about that? I'm sorry, Matt, are you... Oh, sorry, Branko. We just lost Matt. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no worries. I was waiting for Matt to jump in there. I think you're right. The black community, for lack of a better term, is not a monolith. I think there's a real split among African-Americans on generational lines. If you look at the numbers, older black voters tend to gravitate more to Biden, as older voters in general do across the board. It's the younger black voters who tend to go to Sanders, mostly. And I think I would explain that several ways. I think partly it is this narrative of electability. I think African-American voters and Democratic voters specifically, they want someone who's going to get rid of Trump. They want someone who's going to win. And Biden has had this narrative really broadcast for a very long time. It's taken a hit now, and his polling among voters has gone down. But until recently, he was still considered the most safe, electable candidate against Trump. I think the other thing is we can't discount the fact that Biden did serve with Obama as his vice president for 8 years. He was kind of, to some extent, his sidekick, his buddy. And obviously, Biden was playing on that very much in this campaign. Always bringing Obama up and talking about how they're friends. And I think there's a lot of residual affection because of that among older African-Americans. Because, Obama's very popular. He's a very popular president.
Right.
And obviously has particular significance for African-Americans, one of those. So I think that's part of it. I think, also people have not been aware of the extent of Biden's record and how bad it's been for African-Americans. I mean, I could go on for a long time, but suffice to say, the core is correct, but he hasn't really even scratched the surface. Biden really was at the forefront of kind of leading this, for lack of a better term, counter-revolution against the civil rights movement in the 1960s. He wasn't doing it, to stop the civil rights movement, but that is in effect what it did, because he either led through, right-wing, far-right kind of justices on the Supreme Court that ended up striking down a whole bunch of civil rights protections, Anthony Kennedy in particular. Biden was very friendly to him when he and he went up in the stand to, you know, testify. And obviously, not just the 1984 crime bill, but several crimes, including the one that, established that huge discrepancy between powder and crack cocaine. You know, that was Biden. And we could, you know, busing is another one. But yeah, and so there is this paradox. You know, he in many ways has been involved in these policies that have been really, really bad for the communities of color, not just African Americans, but Latinos as well. And yeah, he does garner support. But I, you know, again, it is going down. So I think as people learn more about it, I think people are saying, well, hold on, do we want the first prison?
Well, thank you for the call, Greg. Matt, are you back with us? Is Matt not there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Sorry about that, Matt. In our remaining 2 minutes, we touched on a lot of issues, but we did not talk about healthcare, and you really have scrutinized and you've looked at all the healthcare plans. We've got 2 minutes. What can you tell us about Biden's healthcare plan?
So the most important thing is that Biden does not reach universal coverage. His own plan text says that he only insures 97% of people. so that's at least 3% uninsured, which is about 10, 11 million people. You know, that's, to me, unacceptable at this point, right? I mean, even if you're someone who doesn't believe in Medicare for all, you should at least believe that everyone should be covered one way or another. And he doesn't have that belief. And to kind of contextualize this, I wrote something on the People's Policy Project website a few years ago, or rather a couple years ago. What does this mean? You got 10 million people who are uninsured. What does this mean? If you look at, you know, the increased morbidity of people who lack insurance and you kind of put the math together, what this means is that over a 10-year period, the Biden care plan will kill 125,000 more people than a universal cover would accomplish. And basically everyone else except Klobuchar had universal coverage. Buttigieg has universal coverage. Bernie Warren, they all have universal coverage at once or another. He does not. Other than that, you know, it's the same kind of stuff as Obamacare, really. He increases the exchange subsidies for people who have individual plans. He makes sure that people who have fallen through this, like, Medicaid donut hole thing, they get insurance, and then he has a public option. That's pretty much it. So other than that, it's the same system, really. It's still deductibles, co-pays. You lose your job, you lose your insurance, on and on. It's the same system. It's subsidies, and a few more people are covered now.
Well, you can find the information that Matt has uncovered online at yourcallradio.org. He also read an op-ed in the New York Times last year called Universal Healthcare Might Cost You Less Than You Think. Matt Brunig is founder and president of the People's Policy Project, and Branko Marchetic is staff writer with Jacobin and In These Times. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. And I also want to thank Kendra Klain, Jonathan Linden, and Leah Cesarine for doing all of the research for these shows. You can find coverage of all the presidential candidates at yourcallradio.org. And I'm really sorry about the bad quality of the lines today. We will try to make sure this doesn't happen again. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.